Here's a word that may have come up at the religious summit in Madrid, and that word is jihad. It's a word that's found its way into popular media.
Jihadists are pretending to be Americans.
Pakistan has become jihad central.
And that he wanted to wage a jihad, or act of holy war, against civilians.
It's a hot war all the same, on a battlefield called jihad.com.
The Bush administration has decided to rethink the way the U.S. government uses the word jihad. It's a recognition that in the Muslim world, the meaning is a bit more complicated than holy war or terrorism. NPR's Jamie Tarabay has this report.
It's not just in the news media the word pops up in a violent context. Here's a recent scene from the show Desperate Housewives. One of the housewives, Lynette, is in her yard trying to root out a possum with a pellet gun. Her husband is horrified.
Lynette, I think you should come inside and lie down for a little while.
No way. He's here, Tom. I can tell.
Okay. Now you're scaring me.
Why?
Look at yourself. You've declared jihad on a possum.
I laughed, but it was like, oh, great.
That's singer-songwriter Annie Zonvald. It was at that moment, she says, she realized just how entrenched the idea of jihad equaling violence was.
If Hollywood takes that meaning the way, in the sense of violence, it's just about over. It's over. Game's over.
But it may not be game over just yet. After all this time, the Bush administration has realized the word has very positive connotations to Muslims, and officials should stop using it.
It's like saying thank you. It's like a very positive thing to call somebody.
Duncan McGuinness is a spokesman for the State Department's Counterterrorism Communication Center.
Just like you wouldn't call Joseph Stalin hero of the revolution and people's savior, whatever, you know, you don't want to call bin Laden a jihadist. He loves it.
The center put out a memo in January, similar to that issued previously by the British government. It advises employees to stop using Islamic references whenever they condemn terrorists.
Our vocabulary has to work in ways that don't reinforce the message that bin Laden and Zawahiri and others are trying to promote.
So what does it actually mean? Jihad is considered to be a religious duty, a struggle, what's called striving in the path of God. A quest to quit smoking or drinking can be a jihad. So is resisting an occupying force or fighting someone who's preventing you from practicing your religion. Muhammad Majid is Imam of Adams Center, a collective of 7 mosques in Virginia. He says when officials criticize jihad, they offend Muslims.
You isolate so many people by using that. We need to discredit terrorism.
But critics of the policy change argue the West had it right. Tawfiq Hamid is known for once belonging to Egypt's Jamaa Islamiya, considered a terrorist organization by the US and other governments. He's now an outspoken critic of Islamic fundamentalism. He says some Islamic legal books continue to define jihad in its most violent context.
So what I'm saying is that when these books change the meaning of jihad into a pure, peaceful meaning and stop the other violent ones, then and only then the Western countries should say jihad is only peaceful.
Meanwhile, other Muslims are trying to show that jihad can be peaceful.
The jihad is not a holy war, it's a struggle, and love jihad is a struggle with the self.
That's from a documentary by Pervez Sharma, an Indian who spent 6 years in 12 different countries filming gay and lesbian Muslims. He called the film A Jihad for Love.
For me, it's a really powerful tool, if you will, and a very conscious, deliberate political tool to take that word back and to apply it in the context of Islam's most unlikely storytellers, which are gay and lesbian Muslims.
He sees jihad as a Muslim's internal struggle to become a better person.
Allah will help those who help themselves.
And then there's Annie Zonvald. Her song is called Ummah Wake Up.
People of the world, no matter who you are.
Ummah means community. And I use a song as a way to encourage people to do the right thing and to have that jihad to do the right thing.
When she performs the song, often in mixed faith gatherings, the response isn't always enthusiastic.
People cringe. I can see that when they're sitting down and they're so cringe at the word jihad. But once I start singing and then once they really understand what it means, then they actually, you know, clap along and sing along.
Zonveld says she'll keep singing her songs until there's less cringing and more clapping. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
Allah will help those who help themselves. Don't waste time and wonder why the sufferings we have. People of the world, no matter who you are, look beyond our differences, that way we'll...
Tasteless and offensive, poorly executed and totally inappropriate. Those are just a few of the words that the Obama and McCain campaigns have used to describe the cover of the latest New Yorker magazine. The cover is a drawing of Barack and Michelle Obama giving each other a fist bump in the Oval Office. She's sporting a big afro, combat boots, and an AK-47. He's wearing a tunic, turban, and sandals. Behind them, an American flag burns in the fireplace just below a portrait of Osama bin Laden. Earlier today, I spoke with David Remnick. He's the editor of the New Yorker magazine. He said he stands by his decision to run the controversial cover.
The intention is to satirize not Barack Obama and not Michelle Obama, but in fact to hold a pretty harsh light up to the rumors, innuendos, lies about the Obamas that have come up, that they're somehow insufficiently patriotic or soft on terrorism or any of the other things we've had to encounter. It's a different vocabulary, satire, than essays or a radio essay, but there it is.
But the people who are involved in this misinformation campaign, who are spreading the lies, the misinformation, the untruths, the half-truths, they're outside the four corners of that page. They're not depicted in this.
No, but I think it's quite clear what the image is trying to do, or it was clear to me, and certainly clear to the artist Barry Blitt. And it's made clearer by the title, which is right there on the contents page, called The Politics of Fear. You know, satire is not, you know, it doesn't run with subtitles. A satirical cartoon would not be any good if it came with a set of instructions.
Did you actually commission this piece by Barry Blitt?
You know, the way it works is most often is that artists come forward with an idea, a sketch. Then if it's something that I want to go forward with, we ask them to do a finish, and that was the case here.
Now, I know that this probably happened behind closed doors, but I hope you will indulge me. Take me inside the room when Mr. Blitt came to you with his first rendering of this cover. What was the immediate reaction inside the room there?
It was brought to me by the cover editor, and I thought it was funny and tough at the same time. And, you know, we run all kinds of covers, Michelle, as you know. Some of them are cityscapes. Some of them are seasonal. Some of them are political. We've run probably dozens of very tough political covers aimed at the Bush administration. You know, I think I have an idea of why this is getting some of the reaction it's getting, and that's because much of our audience and a lot of people who listen to you are extremely upset with the course of the way things have gone in the country, especially in the last 7 years. And a lot of their hopes are invested in Barack Obama. The kind of email I get is telling me, I get it, but I don't think so-and-so is going to get it. I don't think so-and-so in West Virginia or out there in the Middle West. And that, to me, is a false argument, that if you can get it, why can't other people get it? I don't think this notion that only, you know, Upper West Side, Manhattan elitists can get satire. I don't think that's the case at all.
You know, there are mistruths and untruths that are spread about virtually every presidential campaign, and there are different strategies for the campaigns to address them, and different for journalists also. That's what I'm asking, is when you decide to ignore them and when you decide to engage and actually get into the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I look at poll numbers and I see that still sizable portions of the country believe this nonsense about Barack Obama, to me that's a very, very legitimate source of critique, of satire, on our cover or anywhere else in the magazine.
For people who are blogging about this, involved in this disinformation campaign, do you think that they are more or less likely to do this based on this cover?
I think it's very much out there already, unfortunately. And it's not great to have to go on and explain a joke, but I would rather talk about that than have misunderstandings out there about what was intended.
Well, David, we're glad you took the time to come out and talk to us.
I appreciate it.
All the best to you. Thanks so much.
Take care.
David Remnick is the editor of the New Yorker magazine. Good morning, I'm Deb Amos. The Vatican is rolling out what you might call Pope 2.0. Pope Benedict is already the first pontiff to have a cell phone and a specially engraved iPod. He's the first to send text messages to the faithful. He sent daily messages of digital inspiration to Catholics at the World Youth Festival underway in Australia. There's no word on whether the pontiff was able to get his hands on the newest version of the iPhone.